Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up. Outcry as Portland protesters face a federal crackdown. Democratic Congressman and House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn joins us as he also mourns the loss of his friend and civil rights giant, John Lewis. Also ahead.
I would just say this, the United Kingdom is watching and the whole world is watching.
The West moves to sanction China over the new Hong Kong security measures. We speak to both sides. Nathan Law, the pro-democracy activist who's now fled to London, plus lawyer Alan Hu, the pro-Beijing Hong Kong politician. Then,
I want other black women to see politics as a career also.
Obama and Hillary Clinton campaign staffer Zerlina Maxwell tells our Michelle Martin why Democrats must engage with black women. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour, working from home in London. The backlash is well and truly underway against camouflage federal agents accused of snatching protesters from the streets, shoving them into unmarked vans, destination unknown. This is what's been happening in the city of Portland in the United States of America, as President Trump deployed forces to quash Black Lives Matter protests against racial injustice. The mayor of Portland and the governor of the state are demanding these federal agents leave the city. And these shocking images from there are in stark contrast to the bipartisan outpouring of praise and grief for John Lewis. The House held a moment of silence to honor the veteran civil rights leader and emblem of freedom. The longtime congressman died aged 80 on Friday after a six-month battle with cancer and a lifetime spent battling and fighting for equality. Lewis was the youngest to speak at the 1963 March on Washington for jobs and freedom. And in 1965, he had his skull smashed by state troopers when he joined the march over the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, to demand equal voting rights. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is the Democratic Congressman Jim Clyburn, the House Majority Whip and a close friend of the late John Lewis. Congressman Clyburn, welcome back to our program. You know, I want to start by asking you perhaps what you think John Lewis would have made of this almost uncanny repeat of the imagery, federal agents, you know, essentially grabbing and shoving and detaining peaceful protesters, this time in Portland in 2020.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. You know, I can only imagine that John would be beside himself. I remember his reaction to what happened here in Washington, D.C. Several weeks ago when the president ordered marshals or some people on horseback to clear the path for him to go out in front of St. John's Church and hold that Bible up. John was so incensed by that, he went, got out of his home that was really should not have been out, and he went early in the morning with the mayor of Washington to stand at Black Lives Matter Plaza to express his concern about what had just happened. So John would be very upset with that. It would be a reminder to him, as it was to so many of us, of what happened on the Edmund Pettus Bridge that day. We still see the film of troopers beating them with batons, running over them with horses and batons. That's exactly what we've seen in these two incidents. So he would be very, very upset.
And of course, even those famous black and white pictures from back in 1965 in Selma, you know, even when John Lewis tried to rise, he was beaten again, and he had his skull cracked. And he said, you know, he spent his entire life fighting for human rights, for freedom, for voting rights, for democracy. He said it seems like it was his whole life fighting. What did he say to you, as sick as he was, when he saw the protests after, well, firstly, the killing of George Floyd, but the protests that then encompassed such a wide diversity of American people, even a bigger demographic than back in the 1960s, even when whites did go to the South to try to help there?
Well, we were sitting on the floor one day, not long after this whole incident. We saw this breakthrough. Black Lives Matter finally breaking through. You saw all the support coming forth. And John said to me, it feels different this time. And we were so concerned a couple of days later when all of a sudden we heard this cry of defund the police. We both reminisced about what Burn, Baby, Burn, that slogan did for us back in the 1960s. So John was very concerned, and we talked about not allowing this movement, this momentum, to be dissipated over sloganeering. And that's why both of us spoke out so strongly against defund the police. We didn't want to see another headline destroy another movement. Headlines often get in the way of headway. And that's what we wanted to see, headway, not headlines.
Well, let me ask you then, do you think you are making enough headway and not generating the kind of headlines that you don't want to generate?
Well, I think that people now see what John was talking about, and I have noticed that the purpose for all of these activities seem to be talked about now. People are rallying around a new Voting Rights Act. The Supreme Court gutted the 1965 Voting Rights Act. John never lost his life back in 1965. And as a result of those activities on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, we got the Voting Rights Act in August of 1965. Now, Supreme Court 7 years ago cut the heart out of that act. John spent the last 7 years trying to follow the Supreme Court's roadmap to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. And so I would think that we would do John's justice if we were to pass the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Act of 2020 and restore the efficacy of the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
So Congressman James Clyburn, how would that work? I think the House has passed its version of it. What next needs to happen to make this a reality? And do you think it actually will happen?
I think that what should happen is Mitch McConnell should put the bill on the floor, should allow it to be amended and named. We sent it over there as H.R. 4. He ought to send it back to us, pass it, and send it back to us with John Lewis's name on it. I think you ought to take the opportunity to put some amendments on to fully fund. It'll take about $4 billion for us to fully fund efforts to have a secure, fair election this coming November. This pandemic is making it impossible for people to cast their vote in person and stay safe. So we ought to do it now, pass this bill, and that would be a great way to honor John Lewis, for us to have federal elections, say, starting on October the 3rd and culminating on November 3rd, to give us ample time to have social distancing in such a way that everybody will get a chance to cast an unfettered vote.
Mm-hmm. In a word, sir, can I just ask you, what is your bet? Will Mitch McConnell hear you? Have you talked to him yet about it?
No, I have not talked to Mitch McConnell about it, and I wouldn't bet that he would do this. I'm just saying what he should do. He has issued a tweet about how great John Lewis was. The fact of the matter is, show us your deeds. Your words are good. Your deeds would be much better.
Okay, so now, Congressman, I want to ask you about words and deeds. The President of the United States, in response to the peaceful protests that have been going on in Portland, has said the following. We're trying to help Portland, not hurt it. Their leadership has for months lost control of the anarchists and agitators. They're missing in action. We must protect federal property and our people. These were not merely protesters. These are the real deal. So, look, the president seems to describe most of these protests as illegitimate, run by thugs and anarchists and agitators. Are you concerned that that might have a spillover effect when you see what's going on, the attempt to maybe have, you know, armed, sort of, I don't know, some kind of President Trump-like sort of militia to so-called guard voting polling stations on Election Day and all the things you're seeing happening in the press right now?
I think this president is trying to find an excuse to suppress voters, trying to find an excuse. All of this is just a trial run for him. The Lincoln Project, all Republicans, members of the same party that he is a member of, has got a new ad out today saying this how it all starts. This is how you begin to lose your democracy. When you allow the president of the United States to ignore the governor of Oregon and the mayor of Portland, and he decides what should be done in order to keep local order. We have never had that before. This is the beginning of the end of this democracy if people do not respond in a way that I think will make sense. We cannot let this guy continue to run roughshod over our Constitution.
Well, I'm going to ask you what makes sense in a minute, but first I want to play you. You mentioned the mayor of Portland. Here's what he said about the result on the streets of deploying these federal agents.
The president has a complete misunderstanding of cause and effect. What's happening here is we have dozens, if not hundreds, of federal troops descending upon our city. And what they're doing is they are sharply escalating the situation. Their presence here is actually leading to more violence and more vandalism, and it's not helping the situation at all. They're not wanted here. We haven't asked them here. In fact, we want them to leave.
So you just said there's danger if people don't react the right way to what's going on there. The governor and the mayor have just said we want them to leave. What's going to make that happen, Congressman?
I don't know what will make that happen. There are a lot of questions being raised about this democracy of ours now. I heard John Meacham, a very renowned and well-respected historian, asking the question this morning, how do we enforce the Electoral College? We got a president who is refusing to say he will peacefully give up the office if he loses the election. That's the way you set up these kind of totalitarian governments. We cannot allow this government to become a banana republic. And that's what this guy is trying to do. And that's what the mayor is speaking out against. He didn't ask him to bring in any kind of force. The governor of Oregon did not ask him to do that. And we already see the governor of Georgia today is demanding that the mayor of Atlanta shut up and stop talking publicly. What the heck is this? This is crazy stuff. And that's what these guys are doing. They are running roughshod over the Constitution of the United States, they feel that they have the right to do to this country what was done to Germany and Italy back in the 1930s. I've been warning now for about 3 years that this president does not plan to give up the office. He does not plan to abide by the Constitution of the United States. He does not plan for there to be a fair, unfettered election taking place on November 3rd. That is what I'm warning about, and I have not just started that. I think you look at your own files and you see, I said on CNN 2 years ago after his State of the Union that this was the case. Now people are beginning to see what I felt way back then.
I just want to ask you, I mean, it may sound like it's coming out of nowhere, but it all together, it just seems as there's some troubling things, as you mentioned. First of all, these reports that we've just talked about. I mean, headlines say that President Trump wants to create his own paramilitary domestic security force, calling them stormtroopers, according to headlines, to use at the voting booth. That on top of this other report about Boogaloo boys. Have you ever heard of these Boogaloo boys, this Boogaloo movement, apparently an extremist movement, heavily armed men, you know, united by the idea that they're fighting against government tyranny. Have you heard about them?
Yes, I have. Yeah, I've heard about them.
And how worried should we be about it?
All of us should be extremely worried about that. And I think that that's why the United States Senate needs to step up. Mitch McConnell, the leadership of the Senate, the Republican leadership of the Senate, need to step up. They need to go over to the White House, have a sit down with this president, and let him know that they're not going to be his puppets, and they are not going to undermine what this country has spent all of this time becoming, a beacon for the rest of the world. This man will have us on the back of history. He will have us repeat stuff that all of us thought was behind us.
What about the state of the nation right now? I think Congress has just started a new 3-week session, and there's a whole new bill that needs to be passed. I think that, passing a new relief package. How challenging do you think, of course, what I'm talking about is COVID, for all the people who've lost so much in this. What do you expect, and how do you expect that to go?
Well, as you know, the House passed the HEROES Act. It's about a $3 trillion program, about $1 trillion of it dedicated to state and local governments, trying to keep people who are unemployed with unemployment insurance through the first of next year, trying to de-politicize this entire effort. This president would love to have this issue as a political issue going into this election. So I think it's very important for the Senate to take that bill we sent to them 1 month ago Thursday. I think Thursday will be exactly 1 month that bill has been sitting over in the Senate, and they need to take it up, they need to pass it, and they need to do what is necessary to undergird this economy so that we can have a country worth leaving to our children and our grandchildren.
And finally, because we've been talking about the legacy of John Lewis, will he get to lie in state at the Capitol? Will the conditions permit that? How do you think the respects are going to be paid to him?
Well, we're going to do everything we possibly can that we can do safely. We believe that John is deserving of lying in state here at the Capitol. We believe that we have a duty and responsibility to the American people to keep them safe. And so what we're going to do is as much as we possibly can do for John Lewis and not put the health and welfare of the American people at jeopardy. So yes, we're going to do everything we possibly can for him, but we're going to do it in a safe and secure way.
Congressman James Clyburn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, human rights are at the center of a decision by the UK to turn on China today, suspending its extradition treaty with Hong Kong and banning the export of any riot control equipment to the territory. Despite the Trump administration's deepening Cold War with Beijing, today's rapid about-face is from one of the West's most China-friendly nations. And it comes because Beijing has imposed a new national security law which criminalizes most political dissent in the territory that once belonged to Britain. Democracy activists are afraid, and our next guest has fled his home. Nathan Law is one of Hong Kong's leading pro-democracy protesters. He's come here to London, and he's joining me now. Nathan Law, welcome to the program. First, your reaction to what just happened today with the UK announcing suspending extradition and also no longer sending or suspending sales of that equipment to the region.
Well, I think the Foreign Secretary made that decision very promptly. 2 weeks ago, I issued an open letter urging this country to end the extradition treaty to Hong Kong because under the national security law, Hong Kong does not enjoy rule of law, and there are several countries committed to it. And I'm glad that today the Foreign Secretary announced that policy change. And I think in the long-term future, there will be more and more assertive policy from the UK government to China and Hong Kong.
Let me just ask you, I know you're a very young man, I think you're 27 years old, and you know we've just been talking about the great democracy activist John Lewis, who put his life on the line for all those years. You guys have done something similar in Hong Kong for several seasons now in terms of democracy protests. You've been met by heavily militarized police. There's been a lot of scuffling. How do you put your battle for freedom and human rights in, I guess, the civil rights and the greater global battle for freedom?
Yeah, I honestly dare not to compare myself to John Lewis because he's been really a figurehead of the whole movement, and he's legendary. And well, from his record, he's been arrested for like 40 something times during his whole resistance movement, and he's been committed to it. And he's a enlightening figure to a lot of our generations. I read about him. So this is such a, well, honorable figurehead for me. So I think it's important that we have someone to learn from. And it's important that that spirit could be like a momentum force for a lot of younger generations who should that fight for justice.
Mm. Nathan Law, you know, John Lewis, despite all the provocations and his own, you know, attacks against his own person and the arrest that you mentioned, he never stopped believing in nonviolent protest. Can you say that you all believe in that as well? Because many were sort of turned off by some of the violence. What is now your strategy going forward, given this new security law as well?
Well, I pay tribute to John Lewis, well, on my Twitter, and I issue statements on that. I'm also a true believer on nonviolent resistance. But in fact, well, sometimes when the government refuses to listen to the people, then people, when they resort to the use of violence, sometimes we have to understand that there's a reason from it. Like what Dr. King said, riot is the voice of the unheard. And I think this is something that we should really ponder and to understand the root cause of why people resorted to violence. Because if the voice of nonviolent protesters could be heard, then they don't have to risk their life, risk years of imprisonment to commit into those violent resistance. So I think, yes, indeed, I'm a true believer on nonviolent resistance. But for me, I pay a lot of understanding and empathy on those people who resort in different ways.
So let me just get now to the heart of this new national security law and its impact on Hong Kong. Now, apparently it criminalizes, quote, secession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces to endanger rather national security. And hundreds have already been arrested under this law. What exactly does it mean for the people of Hong Kong? How different is it to what already existed?
Yeah, it means that it is the end of freedom of expression. we could see people are arrested just because they are in possession of the stickers or flags that have the protest slogan on. And the government issued a statement saying that, oh, if you talk about this slogan, you are violating the national security law. It is clearly targeting the freedom of expression of people, which none of the other national security law in the other countries, especially in democratic ones, do it. So I think this is, a serious breach of our freedom, and it will create a strong, powerful, arbitrary legal weapon for the government to prosecute anyone they like.
So the leaders of this movement are very young, you and Joshua Wong. I mean, you're both very, very young men. And you've obviously come to a decision. One of you is staying there, Joshua. You're coming to the UK. Can you explain the strategy of you leaving Hong Kong?
Well, as you may have observed, after my arrival in the UK, the government's attitude towards Huawei now suspending the extradition treaty with China and the shadow foreign secretary has been really strong, commenting on and concerned by the September Legislative Council election. You see, that change is happening. For the past 9 months, we've seen a structural shift in the UK towards a more assertive policy when dealing with China. And I think my existence also signal a very strong message that that situation in Hong Kong, that crisis is reached to a very worrying level. So it really accelerates that transformation. And I hope that my existence could really push forward only the structural shift in the UK, but also in Europe.
I just want to play a soundbite in response to the criticism of this national law. I want to play the soundbite, which is from Carrie Lam, who's the chief executive of Hong Kong.
The law will not affect Hong Kong's renowned judicial independence. It will not affect legitimate rights and freedoms of individuals, which are protected under the Basic Law and relevant international covenants applied to Hong Kong. They include, among others, the freedom of speech, of the press, of assembly, of demonstration, and of procession. In short, the legislation will not undermine one country, two systems, and Hong Kong's high degree of autonomy.
So, Nathan Law, she's basically saying it won't make any difference to all the democratic freedoms that you cherish so much. And yet Joshua Wong, your colleague, has said this will be the end of Hong Kong as we know it. Very briefly, what do you want the US, France, the West, the democratic world to do about this, given how dependent everyone is on China trade and economy?
Well, what Carrie Lam said is a blatant lie. Because the one country, two system is indeed that. When you talk about one country, two system, the two most important pillars are, freedom and autonomy. And, that setup of the national security law destroyed them both. We don't have, freedom of expression now. And Hong Kong is being taken over by the secret agency assigned by China. So China is asserting autocratic direct control in Hong Kong. So this is basically the end of one country, two system. Regarding the situation, I think the international community should form an alliance, a coherent front that could really hold China accountable, do not omit their human rights violation in Xinjiang and in Hong Kong, and try every mechanism to make them pay when they commit into these human rights violations. So I think in before, the Western democracies or the Western countries have always been predicting that China will open up by themselves. But in fact, this is proven such a wrong prediction. So for now, we should act, we should form alliance and to hold China accountable.
Nathan Law, thank you very much indeed for joining me with your perspective on this. And now we're going to have a response from Alan Hu, who is a barrister. He's also vice chairman of Hong Kong's pro-Beijing Liberal Party. And he's actually joining me from Hong Kong. So, Mr. Hu, welcome to the program. You heard what Nathan Law just told me in terms of how Carrie Lam, your chief executive, defended the new situation. He says, no way, no how. It's not going to be like she says. In fact, as you heard, he called it a lie about what's going to happen to the future of Hong Kong. Can you guarantee, not just to people like Nathan Law, but to people all over the world who value democracy, that that will continue?
I believe that it will continue. And speaking for myself, I will guarantee that the rule of law in Hong Kong will continue to be independent and strong if given the chance. At the moment, Hong Kong is not North Korea. It's an open society. It's an international city. What, in the last 23 years after the resumption of sovereignty, what freedoms have we lost? A lot of international people, I'm sure you have friends, everybody has friends who live in Hong Kong, work in Hong Kong. There's no loss of freedom. It's a very open society compared to a lot of places in the world. In Article 4 of the legislation, national security legislation, it spells out very clearly by the National People's Congress that all the international covenants in force in Hong Kong shall be observed. The whole law is structured for the courts in Hong Kong to apply the common law interpretation. At the moment, there's no exodus from Hong Kong. There's what we is a demonization of this law in Hong Kong, that this is now a city of doom. This is just another mainland city. But ask the other, you know, millions of people in Hong Kong, we're living under this law every day. We're trying to make it work. Every country has national security legislation. Make it fall to international norms. It's an open society in Hong Kong. All justice is dispensed openly here. What is being argued is, well, Hong Kong has been repressed. Well, how has it been repressed? You've mentioned to Nathan, is this a global battle for freedom? But he didn't pick up on that. He said, well, it's a fight for justice. Well, what exactly? What are we fighting for in Hong Kong?
Well, as you know, they really don't like the extradition law, and they don't want to be, treated as citizens of, as you just mentioned and other people think, any other Chinese city, Beijing, Shanghai, whatever. And also, you know, you just heard, you know, if they're carrying protest signs or if they're demonstrating, they say that it could be considered illegal and that could be dissent. I mean, that's not what happens in other democracies. What can you say to assuage their fears, particularly I can see you shaking your head, but I need to talk. What can you say? Because, you know, even Carrie Lam didn't know the full details of the law until it came into effect on July 1st.
The law, when it was announced by the NPC back in May, in the decision, has been made very clear what these four items of national security offences are. And the law itself doesn't add very much to it in the detail. In fact, a lot of people are complaining there's not enough detail. But that's the whole point. If you look at these four offenses, if you compare them with, let's say, America, if you look at your criminal code and you look at your offenses of national security, there's a lot of similarity. There's subversion, there's sedition, polluting foreign power, there's treason. And they're the same, except that they are only there in terms of narrow, strict principles, and the courts will have to interpret what the burden is, what amounts to an offence. The people are not being prosecuted under this new law yet. This is just jumping the gun.
But there's
why don't you let it play out? This is not a play where it finishes today. This is like in Hong Kong. The courts will function every day. Lord Reed of the British judiciary have come out to support, to say that the Hong Kong judges in the last 23 years are a very, very independent lot. And we wish that this will continue and we'll see as it goes. Then why not see as it goes? Why are we so determined to label Hong Kong a city of doom? Why do we want to take away all the characters that make it different? By everybody shutting Hong Kong off, turning down extradition agreements, taking away trade agreements. Before, what about the people in Hong Kong? We have a right to be heard. Can the U.S. government listen to people like me, for example? It's always the same. I've been trying to get through to the British Consul General here, the United States Consul, to say, why don't you listen to a broader cross-section of people? This is not the demon that is being made out into the international narrative. It is clear that Hong Kong is being swallowed up in an anti-China agenda led by America. I mean, it really disappoints a lot of people like me who are educated in it to have the Prime Minister saying today, wow, they're not going to honor the extradition agreement in Hong Kong anymore, and also that we're going to give 3 million passports to BNO holders in Hong Kong. Really? I'm sure that is an estimate given by his advisor that there will be no exodus. Why create this fear? Mm. And it's by our country. Escapees.
Can I just ask you, because you know it really is obviously very a passionate debate. I guess the question really is, the basic law suggested, at least from what I've read, that Hong Kong would carry on in sort of the way it was from 1997 under the you know, one nation, two systems until 2047. Why is it that the Chinese government couldn't wait until 2047 for this kind of, you know, move to happen? And you say nothing's happened, but you know, and you just heard Nathan say, hundreds of people have already been arrested under this law, and nobody quite knows what's going to happen to them.
Well, let me tell you this. It's nothing about accelerating 2047. What has China done? China has put in place national security legislation that every country in the United Nations have. What it's done is it's nothing to do with the Joint Declaration. The Joint Declaration mentions nothing about national security legislation. Nothing at all. It is under the basic law that was drafted in 1990 that the central government let Hong Kong exercise jurisdiction over national security cases and draft the law as well. But for 23 years, this wasn't done. And as a result of the riots last year and the protests and the violence that we've seen concerning Hong Kong autonomy, that they want Hong Kong to be independent or going back to be a British colony. And as Nathan says, if the government doesn't listen, will result to violent means. And this law comes in to put in national security, just like Homeland Security in America does. Why are there double standards? The laws that are being done, passed by Beijing, is no different in character or nature from that of America. And the justice will be dispensed under common law, under the British system. Where is the terror? The demons? It's just about to do this.
Alan Hu, I know that's your perspective. I think some would disagree with you in the US and the UK that the law is no different, but this is to be continued for another day. And we'll certainly keep watching to see if what you say transpires, that the people will be fine and they won't make a huge amount of, legal anti-democratic difference over there. So we'll watch. Thank you very much. We'll have you back on again. Now, as the U.S. election creeps ever closer, speculation is mounting over who Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden will pick as his running mate. Our next guest argues that it should be one of the many qualified black women in politics today. Zerlina Maxwell is co-host of the political radio show Signal Boost on Sirius XM. And back in 2016, she was director of progressive media for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. Her new book, The End of White Politics, How to Heal Our Liberal Divide, argues that the Democrats' failure to focus on communities of color could be their downfall. And here she is talking to our Michelle Martin.
Thanks, Christiane. Zerlina Maxwell, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
You opened the book with a scene that I think really captures what the book is about. You were on a panel at something called Politicon. This is in July of 2018. This is obviously after the 2016 elections, mm-hmm. where the outcome wasn't what you would have hoped. The panel was called What's Next, Liberals? And you described the scene. I'm going to set the stage for you. You called them the id of the Bernie Sanders supporter, white, male, millennial, and uncompromising, raucous, rowdy, and quick to heckle anyone deemed insufficiently progressive. So let's set the scene here. You're trying to get your points across about why you think 2016 ended as it did. You give this radical statement. All of the Democratic candidates will need to do a better job of speaking to and about the issues that Black women in particular care about the most if they want to win the 2020 Democratic nomination. And that's why Bernie didn't win in 2016. Oh my goodness. What a shocker.
Yeah.
But then what happened?
I got booed. I was booed and heckled. And they, it was very hostile. And to be clear, I went to Politicon in 2019. The same thing happened. I was booed for articulating very similar points. The mention of Amy Klobuchar's name got booed from those same folks. And so there's a gender piece, but there's also a race piece that I was trying to highlight, because for so long, Black women have been electing Democrats. You know, Doug Jones is in the Senate because of Black women organizing specifically on their own to keep a child molester, Roy Moore, alleged child molester, out of the United States Senate. And, you know, I think that to the credit of those Black women, they didn't need to be told to organize to prevent that reality from happening. They knew that Doug Jones had a history of prosecuting the murders of the four little girls in Birmingham. And so he had a connection to that community. And I think that more Democrats should look to that example and the exact example like Stacey Abrams, folks who really go directly to Black women and, you know, essentially engage with activists and community leaders who are already doing the work.
I take it that was a eureka moment for you at that meeting in July of 2018. Why was that a eureka moment for you? What did that crystallize for you?
Well, I felt like there were things that were very obvious to me that were not obvious to those who were around me. I think that the folks in the room, particularly the white men in the room, they think they're the majority of the base. They think that they're the most important part of the base. And I was just trying to demonstrate that was no longer true. It's not going to be true going forward as demographics shift and the coalitions become different. You know, now we're in a moment where we have to focus on the specific issues so that we can build this rebuild this Obama-esque coalition. And those folks are a part of it, but they don't even want me in their tent. You know, if I'm going to get booed just by pointing out some of the ways in which we can improve our messaging towards communities of color, and you're going to boo me, I think that you need to do some reflection on, you know, why do you feel hostility, you know, towards a woman of color, a Black woman, making that point.
You make a big point in the book that all politics is really identity right now. Identity politics has taken on kind of a bad connotation in political circles, at least some political circles. You say that that's wrong. Why is that wrong?
Well, first of all, Stacey Abrams, I talked to her recently, and we were just laughing about the fact that, of course, a term that was coined by Black feminists in 1977 would all of a sudden be a bad thing, right? Once it becomes more of the part of the mainstream conversation, as soon as people start being like, oh, maybe that's the thing we should pay attention to, it is demonized by those who understand the efficacy of leaning into identity-based politics as the coalitions of people of color and those demographics are shifting. And so what I think and what I'm trying to say in the book is that Donald Trump has exposed the fact that what we've been doing in America is essentially white identity politics the whole time. We've particularly been leaning into that in this moment as the president runs an explicitly racist campaign, you know, targeting a particular segment of his base that he thinks responds to those kinds of messages. And they are. And I think that, you know, what we need to understand on the progressive side is that we cannot fall into this notion that identity-based politics is bad, because they understand the demographic shifts. That's why they're suppressing the vote. That's why there are voter ID laws targeting communities. We need to understand that the math and the demographics are are on our side, and that identity-based politics is an authentic way to speak to those communities. I'm going to quote Stacey Abrams again, just because she's the smartest person on this particular issue, I think, in this moment. But she says identity politics is sort of like the flip side of I don't see color. It's like, I see you, right? And I feel like that's a really powerful validation to communities who have been historically marginalized and ignored by the political establishment.
You know, it's interesting. You say that President Trump and his whole reason for being in politics is white identity politics. But that's a term you just don't hear very often. I mean, people talk about identity politics. They're generally talking about, you know, people of color, women to some extent, but generally people of color. You know, why is that?
Because we default to whiteness. We don't see whiteness as an identity, and it is an identity. And I think Donald Trump finally exposed that to a lot of white Americans who didn't have to think about race, who didn't have to think about gender or the intersection of identities and how that is impacting people. I think COVID has made that clear to a lot of people. And you see this racial reckoning happening in all different sectors as a result of people just thinking things through in a different way. They're noticing more inequities in systems. And that's important because that means that if white Americans can understand the ways in which their whiteness benefits them in ways they didn't realize, you know, it's those things that they didn't have to think about. They didn't have to think about, you know, going for a jog and maybe getting shot because you were mistaken for a burglar. That's just not an experience that a white person is having. And that's a privilege, but that doesn't make you a racist. That just means that you have certain privileges. You know, I have certain privileges. I'm able-bodied. I have a certain level of education and, you know, I'm socioeconomically pretty privileged. And I would say that that's okay. I mean, I can just identify those things about myself. And that doesn't mean that I'm a bad person or that somebody that has like white privilege is a racist. It just means that you have to have an understanding of how those privileges benefit you. And then you need to reach back and help other people. And that's fundamentally, I think, my perspective on most things is, you know, try to help.
The core of your argument, the core of your book, is that Democrats need to start speaking intentionally to the concerns, the real and lived experience, particularly of people of color, but particularly women of color, because that's the new base. And you say that they're not doing that. But what do you say to people who argue that really it should be policy first, because policy first is how you bring everybody in? I mean, you could argue that, you know, like Barack Obama could never get away from his skin, his face, his name, and so forth, but that he spoke policy first. And because he was policy first, he was able to bring in people who, frankly, might not have been as comfortable with a man of color in that position. And mm-hmm. that this is a way that, you know, women, everybody, people who have traditionally been marginalized, that is how you bring people in, is policy first. That is essentially the Bernie Sanders argument. Why is that wrong?
I look at it a little differently in terms of how you weave the policy and the message, but also consider who the messengers are. So for example, I think that Bernie Sanders did an excellent job of changing the debate about income inequality and, you know, the impact of corporations on our politics and Wall Street and their abuses. But I feel like he always stopped short of articulating in detail how he was going to get us to that vision. And so I think that it's a combination. You have to both message directly to communities, understanding how policies are impacting them specifically. So if you're talking about equal pay with a group of Black women, you better understand how it impacts them in a different way than it does white women. And the same is for Latino women. So I think, you know, you're weaving why you need the policy and how it's going to be tailored to that community. And then you're talking to them in language they understand. And maybe that means you're talking to them on a social media platform they actually use. You know, maybe it means you're doing an IG live with D-Nice, which is something that the Biden campaign just did the other day. So I think, you know, you have to both have the message weaved in with the policy.
Well, that brings us to Joe Biden. Yeah. I mean, you wrote this book really quickly. I mean, it's pretty timely. Yeah. I mean, you wrote it over the past year. But, you know, the world has changed an awful lot mm-hmm. in a short period of time. And now Joe Biden is the former vice president, is the presumptive nominee. I take it you're not a fan. I'm just going to read from the book here. You say the inability of Biden, Sanders, and other white Democrats to even speak authentically about race and acknowledge white privilege is an Achilles heel that needs to be tested. So what now?
Well, I would say that I'm a fan of Vice President Joe Biden in the sense that I do believe him when he says he wants to be a transitional figure. To, you know, sort of a new generation of Democrats. And, you know, maybe they look more like the squad than, you know, the traditional establishment. So I believe him when he says that. So I can't say that I'm not a fan. And I have met the vice president, and he's very nice and genuine and open. And so I'm a fan of him as a person. I think that his policy record, though, I do have some issues. And I just want him to fully account for those issues. Because once you do that, then you can talk about what your vision is for the future. But if you haven't accounted for the consequences of the policies that you did in the past, then why should we trust you that you're going to be able to do anything good for us in the future? Or that we should trust you on the ideas that you do have to build a different future? If you can't account for that, I mean, one of the points I make in the book about how some of the candidates who didn't gain traction, one of them was Kamala Harris. And, you know, that was largely due to, you know, her inability to fundraise as much as some of the other candidates, like a Mayor Pete, for example. But also the criticism of her that she was a cop. And I was like, Joe Biden wrote the crime bill that Kamala Harris, as a district attorney and later an attorney general, was like, that, those were the laws that she was implementing.
And that's where his vice presidential pick becomes super important. So, Zerlina, who?
I just want to say that, you know, it is impressive to see a list of qualified Black women and women of color and just women broadly that he has to choose from. And that's really an exciting moment. So I like to sort of pause and say, this is a moment. But then also, I think a Black woman in particular would bring in a perspective that he needs. He needs that perspective. He needs somebody to give him some real talk about the impact of the crime bill on communities of color and how it ripped apart families that are still actually feeling the consequences of that.
You know, your book is a fun read.
Thank you.
But it's fun. I mean, you obviously love politics and you kind of love the game and you like the people and you, but in a way it's really depressing, to be honest.
I don't want
to because
be depressed.
Well, no, I mean, I'm just, and the reason I say that is you're saying you describe, and we only have time to sort of talk about like a fraction of it here, but the kind of the disrespect, the kind of, you know, diminishment, you know, I know the vogue word is microaggressions. In your case, there are actual aggressions directed at you and other people working in this space. I mean, it's not like it's a new thing to have accomplished African-American women in politics. I mean, Shirley Chisholm, Barbara Jordan, right. I mean, call the roll, you know, Mignon Moore, as you point out, Kamala Harris, Carol Mosley Braun. I mean, you know, but the fact that you have to fight so hard to be heard, as you describe in the book, and we're talking about people who are supposed to be on your side, because your book really is about Democrats more broadly and progressives in particular. What does that say?
Well, I mean, what I always try to do is create space so that other people who are like me can be heard also. So I never want to be the only one in the room talking. you know, I think, you know, what I really wanted to do with the book is to get people to think about this differently. They really need to do, like, we have time, unless you have small kids, you know, we're in quarantine. We have a moment to sit down and think about some of the ways in which we're doing this wrong, you know, how we're not supporting each other. I mean, the fact that we have to tell people to wear masks, you know, at this point, I feel like not wearing a mask is almost like a MAGA hat. It's like, okay, I know how you feel about Black and brown people if you don't wear a mask, because you know that we're disproportionately killed by this virus. And now you're going out and flaunting the fact that you don't think this is real. Even, you know, I have 5 extended family members who died. Cousins. Nobody in my immediate family, but, you know, I have an immune compromised mother. And so it's like terrifying every second, right? And so I think that the reality is so visceral in this moment that it's like, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, it's hard. I have to yell sometimes to be heard, or I have to write a book saying, like, you know, move out the way. This is, you know, what I have to say. And I hope people hear me. But at the end of the day, I want other Black women to see politics as a career also, because our voices are needed in this space. there, you know, Hillary Clinton hired more black women than any presidential, but there could have been double and it still probably wouldn't have been enough, you know? And I think we have to be in every room, in every department. We have to be building the website as a, you know, Mina is a one of the coders who built the website, and Ida is the one who did I'm With Her and that logo. And so both of them are black women. So I feel like, you know, we have to see politics as a job, and it's a career as well, because there's always a campaign. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen if Donald Trump wins again, caveat. But I do think I want to create space with this book. And that's why I think it is depressing, definitely, to your point about being drowned out by booze. But I know that my clarity in sort of the vision that I'm pointing towards, which is just backed up by data, you know, I think some people will see that. And then hopefully I've created a space so other women of color, and particularly other black women, can be heard also.
Zulina Maxwell, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And of course, we are all waiting to see who Joe Biden will choose as his running mate. And finally, in the race for the Holy Grail, the first results are in for a coronavirus vaccine. This one developed right here in Britain at unprecedented speed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca. And they bring much needed hope. The trial involved just over 1,000 patients and showed that their immune systems fought the virus and the vaccine was safe to use. But scientists cautioned that more research is needed to establish whether it actually works on a larger sample and over time. This as the anti-vax movement gains momentum, and experts warn that a COVID-19 vaccine will only work if enough people take it, which is a reminder that in this life and death battle between science and misinformation, trust and public health is everyone's responsibility. And that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.